We've all heard the phrase, that kind of thing doesn't happen in our town. But here on Midwest Murder, we will shatter that false reality. In fact, it happens more often than we know. And sometimes the details of the most horrific crimes that happen in our neighborhoods are lost in the back pages of newspapers, forgotten on our news channels, and eventually erased over time. We're here to talk about murder, diving into some of the most controversial cases in Midwest history. This show will not shy away from the morbid details of these horrific events and the often ugly truths behind them. What you will hear is a detailed timeline of events, perspectives from those closely involved, and analysis by experts. What you will feel is the darkness that surrounds each story, the innocence lost by the victims, and hopefully the justice that was ultimately delivered.
Jonah Lanto.
Don Palumbo. I felt like I was going to run out of breath on that one. I don't know what's going on with me.
Yeah, that's actually...
Williston's got me breathless. What can I say?
That's usually my move.
Yeah. It's actually how that whole thing started. Mm-hmm. Was like Don was out of breath and I was like watching her. I was like, Don Palumbo. She's like, yeah. So that was way back on our first episode. Yeah. We had to re-record that. And anyways, it's a whole thing. Here we are like 60 some odd episodes later. Mm-hmm. And we're here with a sold out crowd for the first of two nights at River's Edge Bar and Grill for our very first show in North Dakota's Western Star, the great city of Williston and one of the most hospitable places we have ever been. So big thanks to River's Edge and big thanks to our crowd tonight. And I just got to say, this is a special moment for Don and I, and because this is the first time in which we had a show. It sold out here in Williston in like 20 minutes, and we made the decision to add a second show, and that show sold out. And it feels really cool and awesome and unique. And we're very humbled by that, but we're also like, that we can offer two shows, two nights. It's a different show both nights. And it's a big moment. And Don Palumbo, hey, nice job, buddy.
Cheers. Yeah.
Cheers.
Yeah. And thank you, Williston. Guys. Thank you. Well, now I have to take a drink.
It's a moment. You can drink with us or not, but it's a big moment and we love it and we appreciate you guys. And we appreciate everyone who has rated and reviewed the podcast on iTunes and Spotify. The comments, a lot of that stuff, sometimes it adds fuel in our tank. Sometimes it inspires us to bigger things. Sometimes it's insulting. Sometimes it's complimentary, but it all helps people make the decision. Should I listen to Midwest Murder?
Yeah, absolutely.
So, Don, I'm kind of curious, what are people saying in the reviews column of the Midwest Murder Show these days?
Well, let me tell you.
Let me hear it.
Duncanomics, one star. Ooh. Jonah, stop interrupting. Couldn't get past the first episode of Johan playing the stereotypical Midwest, guy. Stop interrupting. I usually love banter, but between two people contributing. She was good, but not sure if just reading a script. Probably. They probably switch next episode of playing dumb and reading script. Either way, uneven dialogue. Okay,
whoa,
dude. It was our first episode, man. It's fine.
And listen, I appreciate the feeble attempt at bullying my name by calling me Johan. But let me tell you, that's entry level shit, okay? I had an uncle who nicknamed me Jonah the Whale Fart. So calling me Johan, eh.
Right.
It's mid.
Mid at best, yeah. And just to give you an idea, we are reading a script, but it's one that we have written. Jonah's never seen mine. I've never seen his. Our reactions up here are completely organic because that's just how it is. For those of you that know me personally, you know that I can't tell a story to save my soul. So if I don't have, a script, we're never getting out of here. So
yeah, spoiler alert, scripted show. No, but thanks for trying. Thanks for giving us a shot. I think that if maybe if you listen to more recent, we're more refined, we've come a long way. Mm-hmm. Anyways, we're still here.
Yeah. And then also Societal, five stars. Love the show. I like the banter between Jonah and Don. The stories are well-researched and interesting. I look forward to each new show. And by the way, Don, in my book, they're also still called the Minnesota North Stars. Yes, I'm in the Chicago area.
Somebody's got your back on that.
I know. Yeah. For those of you that don't know, I'm a huge Minnesota North Stars fan, not a Dallas Stars fan. And I will make enough money sometime in my lifetime to buy the Dallas Stars and just dissolve them out of principle.
Yeah. Alternate reality stuff for sure. So, hey, thanks.
Yeah, thank you.
You can review the show on iTunes. We love them. We love to read them. We'll keep on doing that. You can also get some merch. We have newly designed merch. We're going local with the company who supports us in that. And you can find it at www.toomanyshirts.com/midwest-murder. You can also buy us a hot dish at buymeacoffee.com/midwest-murder. Big thanks to all of our Buy Me a Coffee supporters. And this show is brought to you in part by Midwest Memoirs. Have you ever wondered how the stories of the people you love most will live on after they're gone? Midwest Memoirs is here to help you capture the voice of the most precious memories of your loved ones as told by them. This is done with research of your family and completed through a professionally guided interview in a comfortable studio using state-of-the-art recording equipment. The most important stories we will ever hear are those of the people we love most. You can contact Midwest Memoirs today on Facebook and Instagram. Today on Midwest Murder, we're heading all the way back to 1916.
When you could still mail your children.
Legally still could mail your children.
Via U.S. Postal Service. Yeah.
World War I dominates international headlines as Germany invades Europe. In the midst of war, German lawmakers approve daylight savings time. The first country in the world to do so. Britain followed suit a few months later. And they're just millions of people out there dying on the battlefield, and these pricks are in there making laws about what time it should be. It's just, come on, daylight savings. That's who we had to thank for daylight savings
time. But I think
time.
There was a reason, though. I don't think it was...
It's not good enough.
Okay. Well, I guess we'll argue about that on the way home. Okay.
General John T. Thompson invents the Thompson submachine gun, the Tommy gun. Piggly Wiggly, the first true supermarket, is opened by Clarence Saunders in Memphis, Tennessee, 1916. Old Piggly Wiggly.
Some would also call it the Wobbly Hog. Yeah, it's Piggly Wiggly.
Emma Goldman is arrested and imprisoned for lecturing on birth control and distributing advocacy materials. She campaigned for legalized birth control, believing that contraception was essential to women's social, sexual, and economic freedom. She was later imprisoned again in 1916. Also, the U.S. Department of Interior formed the National Park Service. American oil tycoon John D. Rockefeller becomes the world's first billionaire. Also in 1916, Margaret Sanger opens the first birth control clinic in the United States in Brooklyn. She was later arrested for, quote, obscenity, and her obscenity was selling birth control.
1916.
Yeah, weird. Yep. Woodrow Wilson won presidential re-election, which helped him solidify his position as one of the worst presidents of all time. Our story today starts with a fable about Bluebeard. A heartwarming story originally recorded by Charles Perrault in 1697, although versions of the story reach way back into history. A man with a bushy blue beard and a frightful and ugly appearance was looking for a wife. He was ridiculously rich with stacks of garments, fancy plates, gold doubloons, and all the other silly measurements of wealth society used in the 1600s. He was so rich that despite his big, ugly, bearded face, there were rich folks who wanted him to marry their daughters. So Bluebeard wined and dined a prospective bride, her family, and friends for a week at one of his country homes, trying to butter himself up for everybody. The family was reluctant to hand over their daughter, not just because Bluebeard was weird-looking, but he's been married 6 or more times previously, and no one knows what happened to his prior wives. They all disappeared, never to be seen again. But Bluebeard was filthy rich, so naturally, he faced no consequences for their disappearance. And even though these disappearances were common knowledge, inexplicably, women still wanted to marry him. In spite of all this, Bluebeard's prospective bride still managed to warm up to him after a week of partying at his country mansion. They get married, and Bluebeard gives her the keys to his mansion. But there's a caveat. She's not allowed to enter one room in the mansion, or she would be punished severely. Naturally, she snuck into the forbidden room and found horribly decomposing bodies of Bluebeard's ex-wives.
I'm sorry. Can you not smell them?
She's been partying too hard to smell. Like, it's a week of partying, you get married, then you stumble upon a room of dead bodies.
I feel like that should be, like, on the like the application for marriage, but that's okay.
Anyway. Fables work weird. So she's upset even more so because the key she used to unlock the door had a blood stain that wouldn't wipe off. So when Bluebeard came home, he figured out his wife snuck into his extremely well-hidden murder parlor and decided his wife's punishment for breaking his one rule would be death by scimitar. He grabbed his wife and raised the sword into the air, but because of a wacky series of fairy tale coincidences, the wife's brothers busted in the door riding horses and ran down Bluebeard before he could behead their sister. Everyone lives happily ever after, except Bluebeard.
I have a feeling that's not how it was originally told.
You know, I think we're close. Yeah. I think we're okay. Close. Then,
well, I'm not saying you made it up. I'm saying that it changed over the years.
Oh, for sure. Now, humanity being what it is, this fable breathed life into the worst parts of some people. A whole subset of murderers modeled their lives after Bluebeard. While the Bluebeard archetype may seem a bit esoteric, in the 1800s and 1900s, it was a way of life for some killers. Belle Gunness and Johann Hoke are two of the more well-known Bluebeard polygamist killers of the American Midwest. Both were suspected of murdering dozens of suitors by luring them in with matrimonial advertisements. This was big business. Gunness and Hoke collected thousands of dollars in insurance and inheritance from their victims. But the Bluebeard gravy train ran out for both of them before long. Hoke was convicted of murder and hanged. Gunness died, allegedly, under suspicious circumstances in a house fire. So by the time Helmuth Schmidt stepped off the boat at Ellis Island in October of 1913, Gunness and Hoke were little more than bad memories, boogeymen to the otherwise upstanding citizenry of the young United States. Schmidt, like Hoke, hailed from Germany. A jeweler by trade, Schmidt found himself needing to leave his home country in a bit of a hurry. World War I engulfed Europe, and Germany was calling up all able-bodied men to bolster their diminishing forces. While escaping war was a valid enough reason to get out of there, Schmidt was also facing charges of fraudulent bankruptcy for his jewelry business. He dodged the charges and the draft and stepped through the immigration offices in New York City with a clean slate, ready to find his American dream. Which means he was looking for the quickest and least ethical way to make a shitload of money before his crimes caught up with him.
Wow. Are you saying that's what the American dream is?
That's what his American dream was.
Oh, okay. I was like, wow, I feel like you might be offending people no, if that's the case.
No. Before leaving Germany, Schmidt's blue beardiness had already developed. He brought over a mistress named Margarita Baerch, who accompanied his wife, Anita, and daughter, Gertrude, across the Atlantic a few weeks after Schmidt. The family operated under the assumption that Baerch was a housekeeper, though the truth was never really concealed. That's not how Schmidt operated. After working in New York for a time, the Schmidts, along with Baerch, bought a chicken farm in Lakewood, New Jersey in 1914. Not long after, Anita Schmidt disappeared. Anita was the first in a long line of women who suddenly and inexplicably disappeared around Helmuth Schmidt. Schmidt claims she went back to Germany to visit a sick sibling and died there, but there was no record of her ever getting on a boat, much less a death notice from her hometown. With his wife out of the way, Schmidt and Baerch became an official couple, though Schmidt's daughter was told to refer to her as aunt if anyone asked. Gertrude Schmidt was a dutiful daughter. Almost to the extent of being an accomplice, she did what her father told her to do, no questions asked. So, Baerch became Gertrude's aunt / stepmom, and Schmidt carried on his affair. As is often the case with affairs, once the thrill of sneaking around is gone, the relationship cooled off quickly. They kept it going for a few months, but one day Gertrude came home, only to be told by Schmidt that Baerch got run over in the street while visiting friends in New York.
Wow. Just going out with a bang right away.
Quote, she succumbed to her injuries. We won't be seeing her again. Now, Schmidt was a little sneaky here. Was he? No, in this one he was. No, this is the one time he put effort in because he chose actually a fairly common cause of death in the biggest city in the U.S. While being run down in the street might seem a little rare to us now, this was a time before curbs, traffic lights, street lights, stop signs, licensing, you name it. You took your life into your own hands when you stepped onto the street in 1915. As parents, we model reality to our kids. We show them a version of the world, and until they go out on their own, kids walk around with that version in their head. In this way, Schmidt kept his daughter entirely under his thumb. Gertrude accepted her father's world where women came and went with little explanation. They disappeared, abandoned the family, or were suddenly run down in distant cities. Oh, well.
Just like that.
Just like that. So how did Gertrude, at the tender age of 14, handle the death of her mother and her aunt in under a month?
This was a month?
Yeah. Yeah, this is in a month. Yep. Hey. Anita Schmidt disappears. A month later, the aunt slash housekeeper slash side hustle piece gets run down in New York. So Gertrude naturally becomes a spy for her father. Gertrude never grew too attached to the next mom or aunt or whatever she was told to call him. In her mind, it was her and her father against the world. After Bayerch's totally not mysterious death in New York, Schmidt started advertising in the German language matrimonial sections of newspapers. He described himself as having a, quote, very respectable and very good-looking appearance. And he wasn't far off. He looked like Jason Segel with a handlebar mustache.
I'd marry him. I'd be done. I often say that Jason Segel is my next husband.
Oh, and no.
After me, he would need another Schmidt. Like, that's because it. I would be toast.
You'd be Don Schmidt.
Yep.
Getting ran over somewhere. Mm-hmm. So he also said he had a, quote, steady monthly income and was in search of a, quote, suitable lady, not of the servant class. His words, not mine. Mostly, he was looking for impressionable, lonely German immigrants with a nest egg and no stateside family. Everyone has their hyper-specific checklist for a significant other, right? Schmidt, now going by the name of Emil Braun, caught the first of many women through his No Servant Class Chicks ad when he ensnared and hastily married Adele Ulrich in November of 1914. Once they married, he brought her to the Lakewood Chicken Farm, where nosy Gertrude gladly acted as her father's eyes and ears. She followed Adele around the New Jersey farmstead while her father was at work, pretending to be attached to her new stepmom. But every night, when her father returned, Gertrude gave him the play-by-play. Almost immediately after marrying, Schmidt started to systematically torture his new wife. He regularly commented on what Ulrich was eating and made sideways comments about her physical appearance. While Ulrich was noted as being of refined and intelligent appearance by newspapers, Schmidt worked to chisel away at her self-confidence. He rotated through a variety of extramarital affairs, making sure that Ulrich was not only aware of the fact that he was sleeping around, but also of all the saucy details of his sexual escapades.
He is lucky that he didn't get fed to the pigs. Seriously, like that.
He's lucky he didn't try to pick up old Bell Gunness at any point.
Right.
So Schmidt described his sexual prowess around the dinner table the way that other people spoke about the news. Now, we have to assume that Gertrude was present for these conversations, which...
That's gross.
Ew.
That's gross.
Yeah.
And, you know, great, great fatherly role model. Yeah. I mean, for sure. Yeah.
Despite being married, Helmuth never stopped advertising for prospective wives. His matrimonial ads, placed under a variety of aliases, continued to pull desperate German immigrants like a promise of quality schnitzel. He got his claws into a new woman, Irma Palatinus, and took her on as a housekeeper. This guy loved having housekeepers. Once Schmidt hooked Irma, he made a plan to dispose of Adele. Luckily for Adele, in this case, he only conspired to abandon her in Lakewood and bail for Detroit. In April of 1915, after 5 torturous months of marriage to Schmidt, Adele came home one day to an empty farm, All her possessions, along with $3,500 of her money, vanished on a westbound train with Irma and Gertrude in tow. And just FYI, that's $100,000 today. Robbed. Done. Separate from abandoning Adele, it was wise of Schmidt to leave the Jersey area due to the increased distrust of German citizens. While the U.S. officially remained neutral until the last gasps of World War I, they still sent ammunition, supplies, and explosives to Germany's foes. German spies sabotaged American supplies, including one incident where over 1 million pounds of weaponry and explosives were destroyed in New York Harbor. Events like this led to every citizen with German ancestry being labeled as, quote, an enemy alien by President Woodrow Wilson and having to register with the U.S. government. Some German Americans were placed in internment camps based on suspicion. Everyone was on alert. Nobody could eat a bratwurst without catching some side eye.
Wow, could you be any more like just stereotypical German? Like, I'm surprised you haven't thrown the word Fleischkegel in there.
That was them, like, not me, bro. That's that's how it was. Throwing these poor people into internment camps on suspicion.
Oh, I'm not joking. I'm not joking about that. I was saying with the nobody can eat a bratwurst without catching some side eye. Really, do you think I'm going to make fun of people in internment camps? Really?
Done. German sounding food was relabeled with objectively worse names, like calling sauerkraut, I shit you not, Liberty cabbage.
Oh,
okay.
Oh, okay. So, okay. I guess you couldn't eat a German food without, okay. Some side eye. Okay. Okay.
In the middle of all this distrust and nationalism, our boy Helmuth did nothing to dissuade accusations of espionage. Instead, he actively invited them by hanging out near the Sandy Hook Proving Grounds where the U.S. military tested weapons. Schmidt would lurk in the area with binoculars, a telescope, and a sketchbook, and claimed to have been able to draw the entire place from memory. He even attempted to sneak into nearby Fort Hancock, but was stopped and turned away. He always either carried binoculars or, no shit, a telescope, and he didn't even try to pretend he was birdwatching or anything. Instead, he stared directly at the fort while making notes in a sketchbook. Every day was a new opportunity to paint a big target on his back for a Justice Department that was chomping at the bit to bag a German spy. Before things escalated and before Adele knew what hit her, Schmidt disappeared. He knew he had to leave the name Emil Braun behind. As narcissistic as he was, he recognized the strength and tenacity in Adele. There was no way she would give up on recovering her life savings from her deadbeat ex-husband. Somewhere along the way to Detroit, Schmidt decided to start fresh in the new city with a new alias, Adolf Ulrich. That's right. He stole Adele's money and her last name. Now, it's rare to see something that's equal parts audacious and awful, but Schmidt's disdain for his exes knew no bounds. I mean, normally he just murdered him, so maybe taking a last name was a step backwards. Once they arrived in Detroit, Schmidt, Palatinus, and Gertrude found a small place on Hendry Avenue. Schmidt got a job as a machinist at Ford, Gertrude took business classes, and Irma kept house. A month after arriving in the city in May of 1915, they moved to 418 Glendale Avenue. Not long after they moved in, Irma's sister Mina and her husband also moved in. They stayed until August. At some point in all this moving and madness, Schmidt and Palatinus supposedly tied the knot.
Palatinus is Irma.
Irma.
The latest one that he picked up in his
you got
weird
it.
Ad.
Okay. Her family's there. They're hanging out. They get married sometime in the process. A lot of hectic stuff is going on. And with the whole pace of it, Schmidt still had time to continue luring women in with his matrimonial ad scheme. He changed the address and the name, but everything else remained the same. He ran them in the New York newspaper, although now he expanded the enterprise to include the Detroit paper. It wasn't long before he had another bite. A lonely, German-speaking, well-off, first-generation immigrant from New York City named Helen Tietz. Tietz had arrived in the U.S. a few years before and found success as a dressmaker. She had saved $6,300 in her time since coming over from Germany. However, Helen only spoke German, since all upstanding citizens were told to keep an eye out for suspicious Huns. Any German-accented English was enough to cause discomfort in the average schmo. Immigrants who exclusively spoke German might as well have been spies. Mired in so much anti-German sentiment, a desperate isolation consumed Helen. It was in this desperation that she turned to the matrimonial ads in the paper and found a likely man in the relatively exotic locale of Detroit. He so was
for people like dogging on Tinder and Bumble and those things. I mean, it's a lot different than a matrimonial ad. You know, people are just looking for a hookup at this point, right? In life, and where this is a whole other thing.
I feel like I would prefer the modern situation to the old matrimonial ads based on what I've learned so far.
Well, I mean, yeah, you're a dude, you know, like, oh, I mean, yeah, you know, it's,
yeah, I'm the guy.
Yeah, you're the guy.
So in the ad, it read, hey, this guy's 35 with a steady income. He's respectable, good looking, you know. Schmidt conned people for years with a nearly identical ad. Against her sister's wishes, Helen began a correspondence with the mystery man in Detroit. Meanwhile, the shine had worn off on Schmidt and Palatinus's young marriage. Schmidt's domineering side came out in full force, and he limited his wife's allowance, controlled where she could or could not go, and assigned his daughter to another round of wife tracking. And then the craziest thing happened. In December of 1915, Irma Palatinus disappeared.
Just gone. I'm sure that's
as one does.
He must have been going through so much. That must have been hard for him.
Trauma. Mm-hmm. When Irma's sister asked about her, Schmidt claimed she fled the country to South America with $700 of his money. He had detectives looking for her, and he wouldn't stop until she was found. Like almost everything that came out of Schmidt's mouth, that was a total lie. Palatinus was never seen alive again. Schmidt, in his grief, managed to wait 4 whole days before summoning Helen Teets from New York. The two were married by the end of the year and moved to a bungalow in Royal Oak, a small community on the outskirts of Detroit. Schmidt married Helen using his real name. While working at the Ford Motor Plant, he still went by Adolf Ulrich. He also began to frequent nearby German-speaking taverns where he went by the surname Braun. He sometimes puffed himself up a little and pretended to be a former captain in the German army. While his binocular and telescope walks ceased when he left New Jersey, Schmidt regularly met with fellow German expats to reminisce about the motherland. Helen and Helmuth settled into their Royal Oak dream home and made some pretty suspicious design choices, like gluing newspaper to all the basement windows in their house, taking extra care to cover the street-facing windows. While that may feel like a simple eccentricity, keep in mind that any minor deviation from the norm was cause of suspicion for German immigrants. It's the kind of thing your neighbors really took notice of. At Royal Oak, Helen kept house masterfully, while Gertrude kept her eyes peeled for any suspicious doings by her new stepmom. Schmidt, meanwhile, kept being Schmidt. He worked at Ford under a name stolen from another ex-wife, whom he never divorced, and continued publishing the matrimonial ads under various pseudonyms. His extramarital affairs didn't stop, but they were less blatant and aggressive. No sufficiently naive or rich prospects came along, so the next year and a half passed with 0 marriages and 0 suspicious disappearances. He went about a year and a half. Then, in September of 1916, Schmidt caught another woman with not one, but 2 of his matrimonial ads. Because Schmidt used so many aliases, he ran modified versions of his ad in multiple newspapers. Sometimes he was George Roloff, a Highland Park mechanic. Sometimes he was Hermann Neugbauer, a gas inspector in Royal Oak. Sometimes he was a year older or younger, but no matter what, he always described himself as good-looking.
Extremely good looking.
Oh, yeah. Extremely good looking. It worked every time. In his ads, he was the German serial killer version of Zoolander. As corny as it may seem now, his formula was successful time and again. And this time, both George Roloff and Hermann Neugebauer appealed to a vivacious 38-year-old German expat named Augusta Steinbach.
Did he ever like trip up? And I mean, how do you keep all of that straight? I mean, he certainly didn't have a spreadsheet. I mean,
very delicately. I mean, how do any of them do it? So it's constantly writing letters. You're receiving and you're corresponding and conniving constantly. It's a constant living your life of a whole perpetual lie, trying to keep up with all this.
I think I have anxiety. Like
Augusta Steinbach and her friend, Agnes Domaniecki, were both aging ladies' maids in a country growing hostile every day, more and more, to Germans. The women had worked together since girlhood in Berlin, both serving German aristocracy before heading to Paris. With war looming, Agnes and Augusta left France in 1913, the former to Jamaica, the latter to New York City. Having trained as maids for royalty, the ladies easily found jobs with affluent families. While work and friendship came easy, relationships were sparse for both women. They worked and marinated in the isolation of being an immigrant in America. The same desperation that drove Helen Tietz, Adele Ulrich, and Irma Palatinus into Helmuth Schmidt's arms was overwhelming for Augusta Steinbach. As anyone still in the club at 3 a.m. can tell you, desperation drives your standards into the ground.
I think it's more than desperation, but sure.
Augusta didn't want anything fancy. A family, a companion, a lover. She was still young and attractive, full of moxie. She crossed an ocean in order to find destiny. She wasn't about to let the search for love stall out now.
In 1916, she was 38. I don't think she was considered young. Was she?
I think middle-aged.
I'm 38 and I'm not getting called young every day. So
but you're still vivacious and full of moxie.
Sure.
As was Augusta here.
Sure. Is anybody else like picturing, because I'm creating a picture in my mind of how much this guy sucks already. And
It's a lot.
No offense to Rick Moranis, but I keep thinking every time you say his real name, Helmuth, I'm like Darth Helmet. That's what I keep thinking from Spaceballs. And so this guy sucks.
I think he was a bit more charming than old Mr. Helmet, but yeah, I'm with
Darth
you. He
Helmet,
does suck.
Right. Yeah.
Not really knowing where to go to find marriage prospects, Augusta consulted the German language matrimonial ads. She found herself drawn to two different men, both located near Detroit. One was a good-looking mechanic, the other a good-looking gas inspector. Both had steady jobs, homes, and respectability. That was enough for Augusta. She sent a letter to each man and waited. 600 miles away, Helmuth Schmidt penned two letters, one as George Roloff, the sexy mechanic, and one as Hermann Neugebauer, the equally sexy toolmaker. Now, he must have put a little extra pizzazz in the Neugebauer letters because Steinbach chose him over Roloff after one letter. And Schmidt laid it on thick as Neugebauer, telling Augusta he attended the University of Heidelberg in Germany. Schmidt also claimed to own properties in Detroit, including a large bungalow in Royal Oak, where he currently lived with his two quote-unquote sisters, a.k.a. his wife and daughter. And this is where his promises get really good. Schmidt promised Augusta an electric washing machine, an absolute extravagance at the time. And the grandiose promises didn't stop there, Don. He was also offering a new wardrobe and a new car.
I mean, I'd like to see half up front. You know, I feel like that's fair. You know,
What brand is that electric washing machine?
Right. And let's see part of this wardrobe. And car, I mean, I guess you do work for Ford, so I'll take one.
Sounds dreamy.
Yeah, he seems like a real catch. Yeah.
Augusta ate it up. She was looking for someone who wasn't an absolute schnitzel for brains.
I cannot believe you just did that again. Like, seriously?
I had to.
How many other cases that we've covered have you been able to use the word schnitzel? Not once, but twice. And it's not over.
You only get one. I full send on the one chance I got to do this thing.
To use schnitzel as many times as possible, just because it's, you know.
A couple of well-placed schnitzels here and there never hurt anybody.
Well, okay.
Well, so she landed a real estate mogul promising her cars and domestic bliss if she was willing to relocate to Detroit. While Augusta had plenty of jewelry and high-class clothing, she didn't have a lot of money saved. That wouldn't be attractive for a suitor who seemed to have everything. Instead of focusing on finances, Augusta's letters back to Schmidt were all about what she would do for him and to him as a wife. She spared few details. After all, this was a prospect well beyond what she could have expected as a 38-year-old maid. It wouldn't serve to be coy now. Her letters dripped with years of untapped sensuality as she promised him bedroom activities that would make Cardi B proud. In a hilarious turn of events, one of her letters went to the wrong address once, caused quite the ruckus for some of the neighbors to old Helma Schmidt. Like, imagine, what's this porn letter doing here?
That's funny.
So after a few months of letter sex, Augusta agreed to go to Detroit. Domenechi, her best friend, was extremely concerned with the cavalier way Augusta was approaching this marriage. But she still agreed to borrow her friend $300 so that she could make the trip. She accompanied her to the train station, said goodbye, and tried to wipe the dark thoughts from her mind. But Augusta was heading into the boundless American West, and she was ready for a change. Augusta had served other people for so long that the opportunity to make her own decisions, even if those decisions were reckless, felt intoxicating. As she crossed the landscape of a juvenile country, eager to marry a stranger, the world felt open to her in a way it hadn't since childhood in Berlin. Who would this man be? Would he hold a candle to the dapper, golden-tongued, six-foot Casanova his letters had promised? Could he? He had told her when he would meet her, the car he'd be driving, and what he looked like. She was about to find out what Hermann Neugbauer's words were worth.
Well, now I'm picturing Jason Segel again, and I feel like...
Showing up in this nice little hot rod-looking car. Yeah.
Now I'm
ready to buy a jewelry. Show you this new fancy new washing machine he got for you.
I would take a washing machine today, actually. not opposed to it.
As Augusta stepped down to the platform at the station in Detroit, she found out fairly quickly that her dude was nowhere to be found. No worries. Detroit, bustling young metropolis, and her husband-to-be was a busy man. Surely he would arrive soon. Around 2 hours, with no sign of Schmidt, Augusta started walking. She needed a place to sleep. After a 3-mile jaunt to Adelaide Street, toting her luggage and exhausted from the trip, Augusta found a boarding house managed by a man named T.H. Hetherington. Augusta said I'm only going to be staying for like a couple nights, maybe a week. That stretched into a month.
No, I hope he gets what's coming to him.
I hope so, too. Steinbach contacted Schmidt and chided him for standing her up. Schmidt was the picture of contrition. He immediately came to check on Steinbach and fawn over her and ensure her accommodations at the boarding house were acceptable. Now, in spite of all the moist and creamy letter porn that promised electricity...
That is disgusting. Well, now who's interrupting who? It is me, because you deserved that.
Listen.
I'm not old enough to even hear that.
There were great promises of immediate sexual electricity. But instead, Helmuth and Augusta spent a few weeks playing a game of dashing suitor and coy prospective wife. Rated X letters, PG hanging out time. I was like, not very...
They weren't hooking up.
new. Yeah. Now, the visitations carried on regularly. Schmidt came to the boarding house, although he never visited on Sunday. This was a violation of old school social norms, which dictated that if a man decided to visit a woman who he intended to marry, that man would visit on Sundays. And he refused, even though he had agreed to visit on Sundays.
What a...
Wow. That's a piece of work. Now...
As if the murdering wasn't bad enough. Now he's being a fuckboy. That's what's happening. Right? No.
So it might seem minor to bring up his little divergence from society, especially, you know, a silly norm like not showing up on Sundays. But this was part of a greater pattern of narcissism that saw Schmidt regularly taking advantage of these social protocols. In his mind, everything functioned according to his plan. If a deviation appeared, he simply enforced his plan by refusing to acknowledge that deviation existed. Case in point, a week before Irma Palatinus disappeared, Schmidt introduced her as his wife to their neighbor, Grace De Planta. Around Christmas, 2 weeks after Irma's mysterious disappearance, and 1 week after Schmidt married Helen Tietz, De Planta stopped by the house for a visit. Seeing Helen from behind, she assumed it was Irma, and she called out, "Hello, Mrs. Ulrich." When Helen turned around, De Planta realized her error, but Schmidt refused to acknowledge that the original interaction ever occurred.
So he's a gaslighter, too. So he's total gaslighter.
Oh, yeah. As both women stood there embarrassed, he fumbled through an obvious lie that De Planta misunderstood him when he called Irma his wife earlier. He said Irma had returned to Philadelphia and that Helen was his actual wife. Having spat out his version of the truth and allowing for no challenge or disagreement, he moved the conversation in a new direction. As you said, it was a masterful bit of gaslighting, and De Planta didn't know Schmidt or his, quote, wife well enough to challenge the lie. Schmidt continued this pattern any time he was confronted with a mistake, even when all of his lies caught up with him and he was arrested and charged with murder and bigamy. He never conceded a point. But we'll get to that. After a few visits, Schmidt, still as Hermann Neugbauer, told Augusta she had to break ties with all her friends in New York. He allowed one concession. Augusta could write her best friend, Agnes Domenicki, so long as she never mentioned how they met. Augusta, still so in love with the idea of finally finding someone, agreed. The relationship started to take off. Schmidt's next visit was on a Sunday, March 4th, 1917. Schmidt took Augusta for a ride in his shiny new Maxwell car and brought her to his house in Royal Oak to meet his quote-unquote sisters, Gertrude and Helen. Augusta returned to the boarding house and dashed off a letter to Agnes. Every bit of her dream was coming true. The house was exquisitely furnished, complete with a small stream that ran through the backyard and a newly built hen house full of laying hens.
I mean, this guy does keep sounding, you know, like sounding better and better, but his house is legit. Who is
Helen
again? I know Gertrude's his daughter.
But Helen's his wife that's been there the whole time with him. So that's the wife that he originally relocated to this nice little villa.
Oh, right.
So that's his wife, although he's his sisters, both Helen and Gertrude. So
she's cool with being called a sister?
Probably not, but she's rolling with it.
Okay. I mean, she's got hens laying eggs, so I get it.
I mean, she gets to keep house at this beautiful estate, you know? She's... Augusta told Agnes about her dashing suitor and his promises of jewelry and leisure beyond imagination. Augusta mentioned not being... in her letters, Augusta mentioned not being a fan of Schmidt's older sister. Helen, because she seemed morose and tense the whole time.
I wonder why.
I can't imagine why.
Because this shit isn't weird at all.
Freaking weird. His younger sister, Gertrude, however, was a sweetheart. She was gregarious and excited and endlessly welcoming. The wedding would be in mid-March. Augusta told Agnes that's when it's going to happen. So she asked her friend Agnes to send along all of her remaining trunks and told her not to write for the next 4 weeks because the happy couple was going on their honeymoon. Agnes complied, sending along the trunks, though she noticed something odd in Augusta's final letter, dated Saturday, March 10th. Her handwriting looked, quote, scrawly and funny, not at all like the careful way she used to write. Nevertheless, Agnes pushed aside her doubts and focused on being happy for her friend, Augusta. And that was the last time Agnes ever heard from her best friend. On Sunday, March 11th, Schmidt picked up Augusta from the Hetherington boarding house. Augusta arranged for her trunk of clothes and jewelry to be delivered to Schmidt's house at 9 Oakdale Boulevard. As the Hetheringtons waved from their porch, Augusta climbed into Neugebauer's car and the happy couple zoomed off to their new life in Royal Oak. Helen and Gertrude were in the city seeing a movie when Schmidt and Augusta parked in the garage. Schmidt, gallant as ever, carried Augusta's trunk into the house, closing the door behind her. Now, what happened inside next is vague. This was pieced together after the fact by detectives, forensic scientists, and Helmuth Schmidt's eventual confession. The two dropped Augusta's trunk and promptly made love on Helmuth and Helen's bed. After dressing, they walked around the house, chatting about Augusta's decoration plans and their honeymoon. They didn't get far into the tour because Schmidt suddenly grabbed Augusta and strangled her to death with his bare hands. Now, this either occurred in the basement or upstairs, and then he dragged her body to the basement once he strangled her to death. Now, no evidence of dragging was ever found, but let's be real here. This was 1917, and the best tool detectives had was a frickin' magnifying glass.
Right.
So in his dirt-floored basement, gray light filtering through the newspapered windows, Schmidt sawed a hole in the wooden wall, which led to the crawl space under his porch. He dug it out with a shovel and then stuffed Augusta's body inside. He tossed in the shovel, which broke during the dig, and finally, he hammered boards over the hole and called it good. Schmidt then took...
What a psychopath.
Yeah. Just dashed on her, choked, that's it.
Well, got some first and then and then went for it. I mean, a couple of ways. Like, come on, dude. Like, how did Helen... Maybe I'm jumping the gun here, but how has Helen not been murdered?
That's a very good question. I don't know what she was doing right. Staying out of the way, staying quiet, not pissing off Gertrude. I don't know. Like, it's a really fair question.
I mean,
somehow
he got married to two women, murdered.
His favorite housekeeper. I don't know.
Married and murdered. He picked the favorite. In a month. So, I mean, wow.
So then Schmidt took the accoutrements from Augusta's trunk and tucked them throughout the house. Dresses in Helen's or Gertrude's closet, jewelry in a bag inside a player piano in the foyer, and so on. The dresses sat alongside various other clothes that didn't quite fit Helen or Gertrude. The jewelry joined rings from Irma Palatinus, necklaces from Adele Ulrich, and brooches from Old Country Conquests, alive or dead. Schmidt's sinister secrets were stashed in every corner of the house, keepsakes from each victim who fell for his treachery were stowed among his family's daily routine. Gertrude moved the dresses of dead women aside when she chose her clothes. Helen wore plundered pearls to the movies. Ghosts locked in jewelry boxes, remnants of stolen lives packed in trunks and left to gather cobwebs, and walking proud among his garden of blood and broken promises, tall, dapper, gentlemanly, Helmuth Schmidt.
I think you forgot cool guy in there too.
Oh,
I think cool guy.
Super cool guy.
Yeah, definitely a lot of fun, I'm sure.
While his time in America had thus far been one long, unbroken story of getting away with everything, Schmidt was about to find out what Johann Hoke, Bell Gunness, and Bluebeard knew all too well. If you kill enough spouses, eventually someone's going to start investigating. Now, in case you hadn't noticed, Bluebeard killers are notoriously flagrant with their crimes, as if they think they're above reproach. Not long after Augusta disappeared, the Hetheringtons received a wedding present from a former employer in New York. Last they'd heard, Augusta was getting married soon, but the most current address anyone had was at the Hetherington boarding house. Luckily, Augusta had told the Hetheringtons all about Schmidt's bungalow and where it was, so they loaded the trunk into the car and headed for Royal Oak. It didn't take long to find the house, but when they knocked on the door, Helen Schmidt answered, and they were confused. They asked about Augusta Steinbach and her supposed fiancé, Hermann Neugebauer. Helen said that nobody by that name lived here, just me and my husband Helmuth. He's gone at the moment. The Hetheringtons assumed they misremembered Augusta's description of the house and went about their day. However, Louise Hetherington insisted it was the right house. While talking to Helen, she noticed that linens on the dining table matched a beautiful set Augusta brought from New York. The two women looked at them together while Augusta described how she was going to decorate the house. Mrs. Hetherington knew the linens she saw belonged to Augusta. The couple decided to return the next day for more information. When they returned, Helen gave them the same response, except this time she added that she thought, well, you know, I think maybe Neugebauer lives a little further down the street. The Hetheringtons drove around for several hours but didn't find a single house that matched Augusta's description, aside from the one they'd been already sent away from. So they decided to make a visit to the transit company that delivered Augusta's trunk. The transit company confirms their suspicions. Augusta's trunks were delivered to 9 Oakdale Boulevard, the house they just left. And the Hetheringtons were persistent. They made a third trip, and for a third time, Helen held the line, insisting there had never been anyone named Augusta Steinbach at that house. The Hetheringtons walked back to their car, not sure how to proceed. That's when they were approached by Jonathan Welch, a neighbor of the Schmidts.
And at this point, they, like, Helen doesn't actually know about Augusta, right? Because she probably does, but
definitely no admittance of that guilt.
Sure.
But they were gone.
Yep. And when
she was at the movie.
Right. Yeah. Okay.
But on the betting side,
Helen knows.
Yeah. Of course. So Jonathan Welch is a nosy suburbanite. Now, he had noticed a couple pulling up to the Schmidt house the last couple of days and wanted to offer his help. The Hetheringtons told their story, describing both Augusta and Neugebauer, and Welch was shocked. First, their description of Neugebauer sounded exactly like Helmuth Schmidt. Second, Welch and his wife had noticed a pile of steamer trunks in the backyard at the Schmidt house in the past, and they thought it was strange. At that point, the Hetheringtons felt like something shady was happening, but they couldn't really say what. Later that day, Helen Schmidt showed up at the Welch's doorstep and delivered a totally not contrived story about how she goofed and actually did know Neugebauer and Steinbach. She claimed that the couple decided not to get married after Neugebauer lost his job at Ford. Steinbach returned to New York City. While the Welches smelled bullshit, they didn't really know Helen all that well, so they just allowed the lie to slide. It was probably just some harmless case of mistaken identity. Then the U.S. entered World War I, and nothing a German immigrant did could be considered harmless anymore. Remember Woodrow Wilson's labeling of German Americans as, quote, enemy aliens? Well, the Schmidts, with their blacked-out windows, steamer trunk collection, and obviously fake stories, looked less like eccentric neighborhood weirdos and more like German spy ringleaders. Jonathan Welch believed the Schmidts newspapered their windows to hide their furnace because they were burning top secret government documents. Not erstwhile girlfriends.
Not top secret girlfriends.
No. The former, not the latter. So Welch began an amateur investigation into Helmuth Schmidt, and it didn't take long to uncover one of the dozens of loose threads that Schmidt left behind.
Welch, and this is just his nosy ass neighbor, right?
Yes, just super nosy ass neighbor. Okay. It's like, yeah. He's into it. It's like, I'm gonna get me a German spy. Sure. You know, he's on it. Welch asked around at the Ford Motor plant where Schmidt worked and found out that no Helmuth Schmidt worked at the plant. No Hermann Neugbauer either. But when Welch described this guy to the workers, he learned there was a German guy by the name of Adolf Ulrich that worked there who fit that description. For Welch, this might as well have been a confession of guilt. He and his wife fabricated a story in which they overheard Helen saying she hoped Germany won the war. Then they anonymously reported this, quote, fact to the Justice Department. That was enough to prompt an official response from the Justice Department about a month later.
But so this is, that lie probably got more of a response than, you know, I think he's burning up girlfriends in there.
Yes.
Because, you know, frankly, it's 1917. What happens in someone's house is just not my business.
That's their business.
Right.
But, unless you might be burning some top secret spy documents.
This guy's a German spy. Yeah. And they're like, oh, now we, okay, we'll check it out.
He may or may not have been killing women and stealing their money.
This is a matter of national security at this point.
It is. Yeah. And such an intense matter of national security, it took about a month to respond. So a pair of agents, along with local sheriff Oliver H.P. Green, were dispatched to the Schmidt residence in mid-April, over a month since Augusta's disappearance. Now, when the agents show up, Helen almost passes out. Helmuth, on the other hand, lied as smoothly to the agents as he did to everyone else in his life. When asked about being a spy, Helmuth mentioned that he knew some spies and he would gladly give them names. When asked about going by Ulrich at the Ford plant, he said that he did and then offered no further explanation.
Just.
Yep. Moving on. Next question, please. When asked if he also went by Neugbauer, he said that he knew Neugbauer, but that's it. When one of the Justice Department agents found Augusta's steamer trunk in the basement, Schmidt explained that Augusta had entrusted the trunk to him and to send it along once she got resettled in New York. Whatever they asked, Schmidt had a cheery response that checked all the boxes. While the three men didn't trust Schmidt, they left the house convinced that this guy's not a spy. And that's when Helmuth sprang into action. Schmidt pried the boards off his basement hidey hole, dragged Augusta's ripening corpse out, and dismembered it with a cleaver, feeding limbs, hair, and organs through the small door of the house furnace. And he cleaned up the mess as best as he could with rags and then stuffed them, along with some shredded pieces of her dress, back into the hole and boarded it back up.
I mean, I don't want to be disgusting here, but I don't think a house furnace burns
at a hot enough temperature to melt a corpse.
Thank you. Yeah, that's where I was. Oddly enough, I was struggling there, but
I don't know how these old school furnaces worked, but I tell you, Schmidt had this thing going like volcanic, right? And he's so, putting stuff in there.
What is it? It's, you know, July and it's like, yeah, it's about 90 degrees in here. I'm really cold. I mean, just, ugh.
Just. He continued pushing limbs and flesh into the furnace at a constant but careful pace. So I think that was his deal with the cleaver, that it small enough pieces, sure, with feeding over time.
Sure.
Acrid black smoke poured from the chimney. at some point, he went out to the garage, pried up some boards, and tossed in a few more of his trophies. A hip bone that wouldn't burn, the bloodied cleaver, and a few hanks of auburn hair. This, too, he boarded up, then wrapped up the grisly business of disposal. When Augustus Steinbach failed to reappear a month later, Sheriff Green paid another visit to Schmidt. He wanted to go through Augusta's trunks in more detail. However, before Green even stepped through the door, Schmidt handed Green a letter dated April 25th, 1917. The handwriting, which appeared to be a woman's, explained that Augusta had been ill, which is why she hadn't contacted Schmidt about her trunks. Now she was ready for him, and she asked if Schmidt would send him along to 306 East 65th Street in New York City. Another tidy solution to any questions Green had about Augusta's whereabouts. But Sheriff Green couldn't get over the fact that, by all accounts, Augusta Steinbach was madly in love head over heels for Hermann Neugebauer. The Hetheringtons relayed how excited she was to marry Hermann, how she chatted with them endlessly about her weddings and her plans for a reception and decorating the house. If Neugebauer had lost his job with Ford, could that really be enough to quench the wild flames of this love? But Green didn't have time to follow up on hunches. The summer of 1917 brought a crime wave unlike any Detroit had seen before. Unsolved homicides sprung up left and right, and Green ended up not revisiting Augusta Steinbach's disappearance until late September. He finally opened a handful of letters sent by Agnes from New York City asking about her friend. Have you heard anything? Do you know why Augusta's steamer trunks were sent back? Do you know for sure that the letter from April is actually in Augusta's handwriting? Green replied to Agnes asking for her to send any old letters she has from Augusta so they could do a handwriting comparison. With so many murders and disappearances hounding his detective mind, Green began to slip into a dark and distant despair. While he was once considered a bit of a prodigy in Detroit PD, he feared that his intuition was slipping, that he was too bogged down by administrative duties to be an effective cop. On top of all of that, Green had mismanaged the departmental budget and was facing a $17,000 deficit that he had to explain.
Well, that's a fair amount of money. I mean, that's a fair amount of money in a budget deficit right now in a department. So a
couple hundred thousand dollars is what that is, really. Yeah. So stressors closing in from all sides. Green worked late hours, neglecting his wife and young daughter, trying desperately to dig himself out of a dozen holes. Finding no quarter and unable to perform at the job that defined him, Oliver Green shot himself in the temple while sitting at his desk in the early morning hours of December 10th, 1917. Conspiracy theories hummed like flies around the mysterious suicide. Chief among them was the fact that before he died, Green either misplaced or burned all materials related to the Steinbach disappearance. Since some people already suspected Helmuth Schmidt was a secret German super spy, it wasn't too much of a leap to assume Schmidt used his super spy training to sneak inside the courthouse, murder Green, make it look like a suicide, and dispose of the Steinbach file, all in mid-morning, all without being seen. So let's be real here. This guy's thought to be a spy, not a ninja assassin. Meanwhile, in New York City, Agnes brought her case to Detective Cornelius Willems. Willems was a legend in New York policing circles and was known for his thorough, relentless approach to detective work. After listening to Agnes's concerns, he took an interest in the case. He ignored his superiors, who tried to tell him, "You can't take this case because it's outside your jurisdiction." Instead, he started spending his own time combing through back issues of the New York Herald, trying to find the two men Augusta replied to, Hermann Neugebauer and George Roloff. Once he did, he couldn't believe how similarly worded the two entries were. Other than some small details, they were practically identical. Upon further searching, he found similar entries under the names Carl Ulrich, F. Helmuth, and C. Hammond, but similar entries didn't necessarily link these men together. What did link them together were the letters Schmidt sent with payment for posting the ads. For both the Neugebauer and Roloff ad, Schmidt sent letters that ended, quote, care of H. Schmidt at two different addresses in Detroit. Comparing the penmanship, it was obvious the two letters were written by the same hand. Agnes also did a little detective work of her own, combing the Herald for similar ads. She eventually found one and, unbeknownst to her, began a correspondence with Helmuth Schmidt. She wrote longingly about the old country, about her love of jewelry and fine linens and the trappings of wealth. Essentially, she wanted to write similarly to how Augusta might have written to see if this man would attempt to make a move on her, and he did. Enclosed in his final letter, Schmidt sent along a beautiful enameled pocket watch to Agnes. No doubt, this was an attempt to seal the deal. The only problem?
No.
The watch he sent to Agnes was one she already knew.
Yeah.
It had belonged to her dear friend, Augusta Steinbach.
Yeah, dumb shit's getting sloppy now.
Oh, God, that gives me chills. That is so creepy. Schmidt regifted a watch from the woman he murdered to her best friend. Whoops. With Green's death, Steinbach's disappearance was given over to Oakland County prosecutor Glenn Gillespie. Gillespie was respected and feared as a prosecutor in Detroit. He had a mind for details and the patience of a tree. He knew if you looked long enough, a criminal always slipped up. Through letters from both Detective Willems and Agnes, Gillespie set up a visit to New York City to recover Augusta's steamer trunks from the shipping company. He and his undersheriff pulled into Grand Central Station on March 3rd, 1918. Almost a year to the day since Augusta's disappearance. The two men met Willems and Agnes at the shipping company and, after some lock cutting, watched as Agnes dug through the trunks. She immediately noticed the absence of a box of jewelry and some feather boas. She also found a blood-stained shoe that investigators took as evidence. After rummaging through the trunks, Gillespie asked Agnes for any further information she might have. She told him about the house and the sisters that Augusta mentioned in her letters, and her vivid description sounded exactly like the Royal Oak bungalow that Sheriff Green had visited twice. Also, the sisters sounded like the spitting image of Helen and Gertrude Schmidt. Upon returning to Detroit, Gillespie brought the letters to a handwriting expert for comparison. According to the expert, the letters from George Roloff and Hermann Neugebauer were written by the same person. He also confirmed that Augusta Steinbach did not write the April 25th letter asking Schmidt to return her trunks to New York City. That was written by a woman, but not Steinbach. Through conversations with the Welches and Hetheringtons, Gillespie had enough evidence to place Augusta Steinbach in Schmidt's house on March 11th, the day of her disappearance. He had missing jewelry to suggest theft, a bloody shoe to suggest violence, and a variety of names and addresses to suggest the possibility of something much worse. Following up on his last lead, Gillespie visited Schmidt's favorite local bar. According to the bartender, he went by the name of Braun at the bar and talked about a wife named May from time to time.
Gillespie, who the hell is May?
Right. Yeah, good question. So it's another one that he had, another side piece. It's undoubtedly, Schmidt probably had more on the side than is even recorded in record.
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
For sure. He was disappearing all the time. So Gillespie learned about Schmidt's other property at 418 Glendale. When he approached Schmidt's former neighbors, they mentioned a tragedy that sounded all too familiar. His young wife had disappeared under mysterious circumstances not long before Schmidt remarried and relocated. And that was enough for Gillespie to bring the Schmidts in for questioning. On April 22nd, 1918, Gillespie called an undercover detective that was previously stationed at the Ford plant and told him to keep an eye on Ulrich until they got there. When the authorities confronted Schmidt, he replied in broken English, quote, "I no do it." They escorted him to the station, separate from Helen and Gertrude, who had also been corralled by law enforcement. While the Schmidt stood in three separate isolation cells awaiting questioning, Gillespie instructed his men to search the Royal Oak House. At first, they found a handful of jewelry, some of which fit descriptions of pieces given by Agnes. They also found a watch with 11 numerical inscriptions etched on it, the last one being 11-3-17, the day, month, and year of Augusta's disappearance, a possible macabre memento of Schmidt's murders. As investigators dug deeper, they uncovered the boarded-over recess in the basement and the pit in the garage, the bloody rags, the burnt hip bone, lock of hair, the cleaver, a torn dress, all amounted to a grisly smoking gun in Helmuth Schmidt's hand. Without a doubt, Augusta Steinbach had died at 9 Oakdale Boulevard. With all this in his back pocket, Gillespie proceeded to wait 24 hours before questioning each person. He started with Helen. Now, Helen was having a hell of a time even spitting out a coherent thought, much less responding to questions that could implicate her husband for murder inside their home.
Because she was scared shitless at this point.
Terrified.
You know, if she damn near passed out when they showed up before.
Just when they came.
So, yeah, okay.
Helen might have been somewhat ignorant to a lot of this. I know it was really hard to tell.
Yeah, like she didn't quite know what kind of shit he was up to.
Right.
Yeah.
I think willful ignorance would really be what Helen was doing. Like, yeah. She probably knew something was up, didn't want to admit to herself that it was as dark and devious as it really was.
Probably what kept her alive.
Yeah, I mean, you're not wrong.
You know, I'm not asking questions. This is fine. Yes, I like to be your sister sometimes. It sounds like, you know, shitty porn,
I'll
right?
Be your
like
sister,
creepy
yeah.
porn. Yeah.
So Helen shook and wept, and she switched from German to broken English and back, and through it all, Helen refused to sell out her husband. Quote, "He was always good to me," she said over and over again, as if she could undo the situation by convincing Gillespie that Schmidt was a good husband.
Well, she was probably a victim herself at that point. I mean, she was probably beaten down so much by her, you know, his narcissistic bullshit.
Yeah.
Right?
So. Oh, yeah. She was weathered, for sure.
Yeah.
A diligent worker, Helen had taken on sewing jobs to bring in extra money, often working from 5 a.m. to midnight. The couple used that money that she earned to fund the construction of the Royal Oak House. Although they had only been married for a little over 2 years, Helen was invested in this relationship in every way. After answering Gillespie's questions, Helen collapsed on her cot and wept as he and detectives backed out of the cell. Next up was Helmuth Schmidt. Now, this was a prize fight of an interrogation. The respected, dogged prosecutor against the grandmaster liar and manipulator. Gillespie started slow, asking first about Irma Palatinus, Schmidt's former, quote, housekeeper, who disappeared from his previous address in 1915. Easy dodge. Schmidt claims she left his employ of her own accord. Gillespie asked about Augusta Steinbach, about Hermann Neugebauer, about the broken engagement and her disappearance. So the interrogator puts more oomph behind what he's saying and suggests that Helen and Gertrude are going to face charges as accomplices to murder if Schmidt couldn't clear things up. And this appeared to be the first thing ever to faze Schmidt as a human. He insisted with increasing fervor that they knew nothing about Steinbach, and neither did he. Then Gillespie took out the bloody cleaver and the lock of Steinbach's hair. Schmidt stared at the objects, sighed, and said, quote, "You Americans so nice, I know can lie to you," and proceeded to lie over and over and over again.
Oh, good grief, this guy sucks.
He claimed that he chopped up the body and burned Steinbach, but he didn't kill her. With a totally straight face, Schmidt made up a story about how Neugebauer ducked out on his engagement and relocated to Mexico, abandoning his fiance in Schmidt's hands. Schmidt had authored the matrimonial ads for Neugebauer, which is why the letter was in his handwriting. Schmidt didn't quite get to the part where he somehow had to deal with Augusta's body because Gillespie gave him a look, probably the type of look a prosecutor practices in the mirror in the morning, you know, the kind of look that says, "You, sir, are a colossal fucking liar."
I really wish he would have said that. Like, that would have been cool. I feel like that's a power move, right? Like, this is, you know, this is a...
It would, at least, the look stopped him dead in his tracks.
Right. In an obvious big dick contest, he's like, mine's bigger. So, I mean, I wish he would have said that.
It's all on the table.
It's okay.
As Schmidt paused in the middle of his pile of lies and noticed Gillespie's look, he deflated. Slumped and defeated, Schmidt finally changed tones and admitted to pretending to be both Neugebauer and George Roloff. Steinbach had come to his home on March 11th. The two had sex, and Augusta told Schmidt he had to leave his wife and marry her. Schmidt refused, which sent Augusta running through the house to the bathroom, where Schmidt followed her in an attempt to console her. She then took out some sort of white powder, ingested it, and fell over dead instantly.
Right. Yeah. I'm going to poison myself.
Ugh. Oh, no. I mean, it's totally possible.
Yeah.
Right? No. Am I right? Am I right? No?
No.
No? Is no. Schmidt right?
No, you're full of no. shit.
He's full
no.
of shit.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah.
So anyway, from there, the storing of the corpse, dismemberment, and hiding of the various murder-related objects all aligned with what police had discovered. However, the magical, murderous white powder was just too much of a leap for Gillespie. He knew Schmidt wasn't giving up the full story. After hours of questioning and circling around the truth, Schmidt was gassed. He agreed to make a formal statement, including everything he knew about Augusta's murder, the whereabouts of Irma Palatinus, and anything else they wanted to know. All he needed was a lunch break to gather his thoughts. Gillespie could sense a hint of truth in Schmidt, so he sent for a stenographer to make sure he got the full confession down verbatim. And then Gillespie went to take a lunch break. The chief at the station locked the cell and told Schmidt, quote, "You know you haven't told all the truth. You know you killed the girl." Then he walked away. A few minutes later, a metallic thud reverberated through the station. The captain ran toward the source of the noise and saw Schmidt lying face down, a crimson circle of blood spreading around his head. He quickly unlocked Schmidt's cell and surmised what happened. The iron bed frame chained and hinged to the wall to allow for the bed to be folded up when not being used was sprayed with blood on a corner. As soon as the police and Gillespie left to get lunch, Schmidt lifted the heavy bed frame as high as he could, then swung it down, fracturing his skull in several places, killing him instantly.
But, okay.
Scribbled in English across the back wall was the simple phrase, "Wife and child innocent." It was finished, but there was no closure in suicide, just endless unanswered questions. It was the best Gillespie would receive in the case of the disappearing domestic. There would be no comprehensive confession, no satisfying wrap-up or seeking of absolution by the guilt-ridden. Rather than tell the truth for once in his life, Helmuth Schmidt opted to end his own. He attempted, in his death, to carry all the blame and responsibility for his misdeeds to the grave. However, there was the matter of his estate to figure out, such as the complex legal battle of the deceased bigamist. After a drawn-out process in probate court, Helen, Gertrude, and Adele Ulrich, that he abandoned way back when?
That was when she got back, and
he stole her $3,500 and bailed.
Okay.
Helen, Gertrude, and Adele split Schmidt's estate three ways. Helen kept the house at Royal Oak. Gertrude received some furniture and fine silverware. And Helen received the house at 418 Glendale in Detroit. The three lived out their lives in mild obscurity, distant from everything that the man of all three, who they loved in their own way, all three were left to pick up the pieces of a beautifully designed life built upon a shifting foundation of well-woven lies. It's the part we don't see in the Bluebeard myth. How does the final ex-wife move on? How could any of them learn to love again? Each of their lives had been poisoned, their ability to trust decimated by a man who lied with every breath, a man who reduced love to dollar signs and bones and ash, a man who shaved away every pretty myth built around the American dream until all that was left was make money at any cost.
I'm going to go out on a limb here and make a pretty fair educated guess that they probably didn't answer any matrimonial ads from anyone. At least I would hope not.
Yeah, not the way to find love.
No, well, not here.
Not in this case. And that cost, what was it? It was the confirmed murders of Augusta Steinbach and Irma Palatinus, as well as the mysterious deaths of Anita Schmidt and Margareta Bärtsch. There was also that gold watch with 11 dates inscribed on its cover, one of which aligned with the date of Steinbach's disappearance and probable death. All told, Schmidt was implicated in four deaths, was guilty of multiple counts of bigamy, and had abandoned at least two other wives. His estate was worth around $20,000 when he died.
Wow.
That's $400K today. Most of which was siphoned away from his spouses and, quote, housekeepers.
It wasn't frickin' his, that's for sure. Wow.
As Agnes Domenicki said when she learned the truth about Augusta, das heiraten Teufel. Translated into English, the phrase means, quote, she married the devil.
I bet that was like fluent German you just spoke.
Was I good at that? I don't know.
I don't think so.
I don't know.
I don't think so.
It's the first time. My first German speaking phrase, aside from practicing.
Right.
I think I did pretty good.
It was well done. I mean, well done.
I did as good as the YouTube voices that did it, like when I listened. So I trained for that, Don Palumbo.
I'm proud of you. Well done.
Sources for this episode of Midwest Murder: the book, The Shocking Story of Helmuth Schmidt, Michigan's Original Lonely Hearts Killer by Tobin Book. Also, www.bl.uk, collection items, The History of Bluebeard, etc.usf.edu, fairy tales and other traditional stories, www.neversuchinnocence.com/Germany, murderpedia.org, Johann Hoke, and www.onthisday.com/events1916. This episode of Midwest Murder was co-written by Tyler Hancock and myself, Jonah Lanto. It's produced at the Good Talk Network, recorded live with a sold-out audience here at the River's Edge Grill and Bar in Williston, North Dakota. Thank you very much.